We are both here.
Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Riley, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, all, and welcome to this February 18 panel of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I will state for the record what counsel are already aware of, which is that the proceedings today are being managed through the Zoom platform online rather than live at the Minnesota Judicial Center. And what that means for counsel is that you'll need to state your name as you begin each leg of your argument, even though we can see each other on the screen. We're only producing an audio recording of the proceeding, and we're not video recording. And of course, by rule, no one is to be video recording the proceedings. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 15 minutes for your argument with an additional 5 minutes for a rebuttal. And counsel for respondent, I understand that you intend to have multiple attorneys arguing.
Yes, Your Honor. We have two attorneys, Ms. Deanna Thompson and myself, Jessica Gutierrez. We'd like to split our time between the two issues, 7.5 minutes each, if the court is okay with that.
So what we'll do is this. I take it you're both present in the same location?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. So what we'll do is this, since you're both representing the same client rather than different clients, I'm just going to go ahead and keep your clock running at 15 minutes total. And we'll leave it to you to end your argument so your co-counsel can join in, and you can do so at whatever time increment you like. If you choose to take up all of the time, you may. You may have to buy your colleague lunch if you eat up all of the time, though. In any event, you will have 15 minutes for your responsive arguments. Do you understand how that'll work?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. We'll pause the clock, and I'll have the marshal pause the clock momentarily so that while you're switching, we won't be deducting any time from you. But we'll leave it to you to decide as you go how to divide the time. And if you'd like to do so exactly immediately in the middle of the argument or in the middle of your time allotted, please be mindful of the clock, which if you keep your screen open to gallery view versus speaker view, you should be able to see the clock throughout the entire time of your argument. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed whenever you are ready. I should state, I don't think I ever said we are here in the case of Diallo versus Jallo, for the record. Counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning to all. May it please the court, counsel. This case is about an order for protection that was issued against the appellant from testimony by the respondent claiming that she feared for herself even though she was not living with the appellant. The appellant believes that the district court abused its discretion when it found for the respondent because it considered abuses that were only supported by, that were not supported by evidence, excuse me, but was only supported by testimony by the respondent, but there was no physical evidence. And the appellant believes that the district court did not properly weigh his testimony when considering the OFP.
Just so we're clear, you're saying because there was there was testimonial evidence, but not physical evidence, therefore the district court clearly erred in crediting the testimonial evidence?
There was no physical evidence to show that the appellant did abuse the respondent, and I'm not here to set precedent in terms of saying that physical evidence is required to show this, but it was simply the testimony of the respondent that the district court took into consideration, and this was testimony.
I thought if I read the district court's analysis correct, the district court took all of the testimony into consideration and weighed the evidence, weighed the testimony, decided which testimony was credible and which testimony was not credible. Do you read the record differently from the way I read it?
No, you are correct in that part, Your Honor. What I am saying, though, is that it did not weigh the testimony equally, I believe, and that was because the district court did also refuse to listen to certain testimony from the appellant, and it said so, and this was due to discovery issues that were being handled by the appellant's attorney at the time.
Right, but the testimony that was received by the court was weighed by the court. You're not suggesting, are you, that the district court was required to weigh all of the testimony equally if it found credible testimony on one hand and incredible testimony on the other?
Well, if they had weighed the testimony equally, which again, the appellant does not believe that that happened, they would have noticed that there were the appellant and the respondent met over Facebook, and the respondent came from her country to the United States, but never claimed any abuses or indiscretions while in that country, only began to do so as soon as she arrived in this country.
Therefore, and what?
So, pardon me?
So what?
So it just, it appears that the district court took on the word of the respondent alone without taking into consideration the appellant's testimony in basically claiming that the respondent was doing all of this for her green card.
Right. The district court, let me go back to my original concern. You seem to be suggesting that that your client was entitled to have a credibility determination in his favor because Ms. Diallo had a credibility determination in her favor. If the district court disbelieved your client and believed Ms. Diallo, which I assume you're recognizing is a perfectly appropriate act of discretion in the district court, on what basis would we agree with you that your client did not engage in domestic abuse against Ms. Diallo?
Was simply because there was no actual evidence to show that domestic abuse actually occurred. And the testimony of the appellant as such was not taken into consideration as equally as the testimony that was given by the respondent.
And what do you mean by equally? I just don't understand what you mean by that.
Equally in terms of the way that we see it is that the district court abused its discretion by taking the testimony of the appellant and disregarding it. And we believe that that was done due to issues with the appellant's attorney at the time.
So in on page five, I guess, of the addendum, I'm not exactly sure, but it's finding 25. The court finds, it sounds like the court did weigh the credibility, and the court finds that petitioner was more credible than respondent. Respondent's explanations did not ring true to the court. And so the court.
Whoops, Judge Riley, I think you've muted yourself.
Did that accidentally. Thank you, Judge Ross. I'll put my mouse away. You cite to Kloss to support your arguments with regard to your definitions of domestic abuse, but you know that the Supreme Court specifically overruled Kloss in the Thompson case. And so why are you citing to a case that's been overruled?
You are correct, Your Honor. Kloss was overruled by Thompson. And the reason that I do cite to Kloss is to show that there was no imminent physical threat to the respondent. And it was because she had left the home, but also to show that there was no abuse even at the time that she was living with the appellant.
Hold on a second. Let me press you on that. Let me state five propositions and you tell me whether any of them is wrong. Ms. Diallo testified that Mr. Jala used force to have sex with her against her will. The district court credited Ms. Diallo's testimony that Mr. Jala used force to have sex with her against her will. Minnesota law criminalizes as criminal sexual conduct using force against a person to have sex against her will. And Minnesota law characterizes criminal sexual conduct as domestic abuse. And domestic abuse is a basis for granting an order for protection. I said five. I think that maybe, no, I think that was six. No, five. That was five statements. Do you think I incorrectly stated any of those propositions, or whether any of those are erroneous?
No, Your Honor, you did not. Nothing was wrong in your statements there. What we are alleging is that there was not enough evidence to show that any of those things actually happened to Ms. Diallo.
What do you mean? Okay, let me go back a minute. Ms. Diallo testified that they happened to her. The district court said, I believe you, Ms. Diallo. So you want us to just disregard her testimony and the district court's finding of her testimony as credible and conclude that there was no evidence that it happened?
All we are saying is that the testimony by both parties.
I'm going to go back to my question. That's a yes or no question. I'm lost in your argument. Are you saying that you want us to hold as a matter of law, as you've said, that there is no evidence that she was the victim of criminal sexual conduct?
No, what we are saying is that because the district court abuses discretion and not taking the testimony and not listening to both sides of the testimony equally and weighing it equally, that there was an abuse of discretion there.
So what is the case that you found that most supports this proposition you keep asserting, that the district court was somehow bound as a matter of law to weigh the testimony, competing testimony, of two different witnesses, quote, equally? And while you're thinking about that, I'd also like you to consider how it's possible for a district court to consider testimony equally when it's contradicting each other. How is that even possible?
The way that it could have been looked at equally, Your Honor, is had the district court taken into consideration the fact that no abuses were conducted in their originating country and only began basically the day that Ms. Diallo arrived into this country.
You're avoiding my logic question. My logic question is a simple one. How can anyone, district court, carrot, inanimate object, how can anyone weigh testimony equally from two parties when the testimony is mutually exclusive? One says X, one says not X, and you say as a matter of law that the fact finder is obliged to weigh both X and not X equally. How can that occur as a matter of just logic?
Well, by listening to all of the testimony and allowing all of the evidence to be presented, and there was certain testimony and certain evidence that was not presented in this case. And again, that was due to discovery issues between both counsels at the time and the judge ruling that certain testimony, certain evidence would not be allowed to be presented. And it was because counsel at the time did not comply with discovery orders and rules.
Just to be clear, since you've moved on to the other issue, I gather you're conceding that it is illogical for a court to weigh equally conflicting testimony. You're arguing now something different, correct?
I will concede that, Your Honor.
All right. I think Judge Riley has a question.
I want to make two observations. The first observation is that I am not persuaded by your argument that nothing happened back in the country in Guyana before the respondent came to America, because it is hard to commit acts of criminal sexual conduct over Facebook. So that's number one. Number two, your client did get to testify about the course of their relationship, and the fact that he wasn't able to present other witnesses also is unpersuasive with regard to criminal sexual conduct, because it's very rare that there are witnesses to that. It involves the two people who are there. And so I also find that unpersuasive. Maybe you want to respond to how that impacts your argument with regard to the judge imposing certain discovery sanctions.
Well, on the first part, Your Honor, while the two parties did meet over Facebook, My understanding was that the appellant did travel to the country where Ms. Diallo was from and did meet her there. And there were no abuses that were reported coming from there by Ms. Diallo.
And the once second, again, not surprising since presumably your client was courting her.
The second point that you make, they did have a roommate that was living in the same home, in the same apartment, I should say, with them, who would have been able to testify if there was any sexual abuses that were conducted or not. However, that roommate was not allowed to testify. There is an issue of them being in a fight, but I do believe that that would have been one of the witnesses.
Well, let's talk about that. Your argument that the district court improperly imposed sanctions by not allowing testimony. As I read your, what looks like an ineffective assistance of counsel argument, you say that counsel failed by violating discovery rules. So I assume that that is an admission that your client failed to follow discovery rules. And in light of that, how is it that the district court abuses discretion by imposing a sanction for your client's violation of discovery rules?
I think had the district court listened to all of the testimony and allowed for some of the witnesses to have been presented or some of the evidence to have been presented, the outcome would have been very different. Now, with
okay, that's not okay. But the issue now isn't what would the outcome have been if the witnesses would have been allowed to testify. The issue is your argument that the district court improperly excluded that evidence. So my question for you is, given your admission in your brief that there was a failure on behalf of your client to follow discovery rules, on what basis would we say that the district court abuses discretion with the sanction that it imposed?
I do not believe that that would be possible, Your Honor. I concede that argument as well.
You also make an argument that there's some kind of a constitutional basis for your client's right to an attorney at an order for protection hearing. Which constitutional provision are you referring to?
I don't believe that I mentioned that there it is a constitutional provision, but I do cite to...
Well, you said your client had a right to effective assistance of counsel, which arises from the Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution. So if you're saying that there's a right to counsel based upon effective assistance, I presume it arises from that provision of the Constitution or some other one. If not, maybe you, if you're conceding that there is no constitutional basis for your argument, what's the statutory basis for your argument?
I believe, Your Honor, what the argument that I was trying to make was the fact that my the fact that the appellant actually decided to bring on an attorney and put his faith and trust into that attorney, that the attorney should have done his very best in order to present the arguments properly, defend his client properly, as well as follow all the rules of civil procedure
that were required of him. I understand that you feel that way. My question for you is, on what basis as a matter of law would we say that any failure by your client's previous counsel to meet whatever standard you believe is appropriate is a basis for reversing the order for protection decision?
It was because the attorney did not properly represent the appellant in an appropriate manner or in a manner that an attorney is supposed to represent. Well,
I understand that's your argument. My question is, why as a matter of law, if that's so, on what legal basis, what statute, what constitutional provision, what rule of court, would we reverse the district court's order for protection?
Well, I would believe that it is just under the rule of ethics of the attorneys to be able to represent a client appropriately and properly and to the best of their ability.
So it would be, if I'm clear, it's the, some ethical rule would lead us to reverse.
Correct, Your Honor.
And I recognize your time has expired, but you can answer this last question. Were you able to find any case that supports that theory?
I did not.
Were you able to find an exact rule of ethics that supports that theory?
I did not find that, Your Honor, specifically. The only thing that I that I did find, and I believe it is in my reply brief, is just Judge Sweet of the Southern District of New York made an argument for the right to counsel in civil cases in a 97 ARPS lecture. In short, we need a civil Gideon that is an expanded constitutional right to counsel in civil matters.
And that civil Gideon theory has not been adopted, as far as you know, anywhere in the country.
It has been adopted in some areas. It has not been adopted in Minnesota. There is a push for it to be adopted in Minnesota, but it has not been adopted as of
okay.
this.
Thank you. We understand your argument. Counsel for respondent.
Yes, Your Honors. My name is Deanna Thompson for the respondent, Fatoumata Binta Diallo. May it please the court. So appellant raised two issues. The first, that the district court abused its discretion by granting Ms. Diallo an order for protection. And second, that appellant was denied a full hearing. I will be addressing the first, and my colleague, Jessica Gutierrez, will address the second. So the district court did not abuse its discretion by granting Ms. Diallo an order for protection. First, the record clearly supports the grant of an OFP. And second, appellant's arguments in his briefs clearly misunderstand current Minnesota law. So first, let's talk about the record clearly supporting the grant of an order for protection. Now, throughout appellant's briefs and his arguments today, he has tried to make this case seem a lot more complicated than it is. But the truth is, this case could not be more straightforward. And that's because if we look at Thompson, it set out what can be thought of as a two-step process in determining whether to grant an order for protection. So the first step being whether or not domestic abuse actually occurred, and then the second step being whether the totality of the circumstances support the grant of an order for protection. And as Your Honors pointed out during appellant's arguments, there were numerous instances that could constitute domestic abuse. One that we did not mention during appellant's arguments is that Mr. Diallo was physically violent with Ms. Diallo. He pushed her to the ground and left her bruised. Another point I want to make is that in appellant's arguments, he asserted that this is somewhat of a he said, she said. It was Ms. Diallo's word versus Mr. Diallo's. That's not the full story. Ms. Diallo also called her sister or her cousin, Ms. Gibson. It's culturally her sister, but biologically her cousin, to testify. And Ms. Gibson said that she saw the bruises on Ms. Diallo's arms. Ms. Gibson also spoke with Mr. Diallo shortly after it happened.
How long before the OFP trial had this incident occurred where Mr. Diallo pushed Ms. Diallo to the ground?
It would have been within the year because they were only married for a year. I don't remember the exact date, but I do believe it was in March.
How long had they been separated at the time of the hearing?
At the hearing, which occurred in March, they had been separated for, so she moved out in December, and that is when she filed the order for protection. But because of appellant's discovery issues as far as not taking depositions, and then also there were scheduling issues, we ended up needing a full day in court. We did not have the hearing until March. So between when she filed the order for protection in March and when the hearing actually occurred would have been 3 months. But she filed an order for protection and received an ex parte order almost immediately after fleeing from him and arriving at a domestic abuse shelter. Further,
is there any indication that these two would have had any ongoing encounters in light of the separation?
Yes, Your Honor. Even though Ms. Diallo was granted an ex parte order, she testified that Mr. Diallo attempted to contact her through another person. He clearly wanted to communicate with her, and he thought that he could skirt around the ex parte order by having his family contact her. This suggests that he would try to contact her directly if he did not have some sort of bar protecting, forbidding him from doing so. Because he physically abused her, because he forced sexual abuse on her, and because the district court found those that testimony of Ms. Diallo's credible, the district court was correct to determine that there was domestic abuse. And then the district court was then able to step back and look at the totality of the circumstances to look at whether or not the grant of an order for protection was warranted. So that allowed the district court to look at other factors. For example, the fact that he would not allow his wife to have a key to their home. He would not let her, when he was angry with her, attend classes to learn English so that she could eventually get a job. He also admitted to planting listening devices in her apartment for the explicit purpose of spying on her. The district court noted in its order that it found all of those things relevant. It painted a picture of this controlling, abusive marriage, which was the basis for the, which support the district court ultimately granting the order for protection. And as your honors pointed out, and as I believe appellant has now conceded, that Cass is no longer, has been overruled by Thompson. And so therefore, many of appellant's arguments in their brief as far as the need for proving imminent harm or present intent to do physical, to do harm aren't relevant, because in this case, Ms. Diallo alleged all three types of domestic abuse. She alleged physical harm, fear of imminent harm, and criminal sexual conduct, three definitions.
I mean, the argument is still relevant despite the overturning of the decision, because I mean, there's still, the district court still has some bounds and discretion as to whether or not an order for protection is appropriate, doesn't it? I mean, wasn't the reversal or the overturning simply stating as a matter of law that the elements don't include the imminency of the fear?
Yes, Your Honor, but the district court, when it exercised its discretion, did find that Ms. Diallo did have reason to fear for her life. There were multiple mentions in the order about how Ms. Diallo was afraid for her life and how Ms. Gibson, her cousin, also feared for her life, and how the district court believed the both of them. And to the other point of that it did not believe Mr. Diallo. It noted that, and it's clear from the record, that when Mr. Diallo was questioned about these things by his own attorney, he would simply say, not true, didn't happen. He would deny it without any sort of explanation. So as outlined in our briefs, the record clear, which includes 3 days of evidentiary hearings and several detailed orders, contains ample evidence that appellant committed acts of domestic abuse against Ms. Diallo, and that the totality of the circumstances support the grant of an order for protection. Appellant has not and cannot demonstrate that the district court abused its discretion in granting an order for protection. And now my colleague will speak on appellant's second issue and explaining why Mr. Diallo received a full hearing. Thank you.
Your Honors, my name is Jessica Gutierrez on behalf of the respondent, Ms. Diallo. May it please the court. I'll be addressing the issues of whether the respondent was afforded a full hearing at the trial court level, and also the appellant's argument that he received ineffective assistance of counsel. Your Honors, the hearing in this case took place over 3 days. During that hearing, the appellant presented witness testimony, he introduced evidence, he cross-examined witnesses, and it was in every respect a full hearing. The appellant alleges first that the trial court abused its discretion in excluding certain evidence. Your Honors, the court has broad discretion in discovery rulings, and the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure specifically contemplate exclusion of evidence as a sanction for failure to engage in discovery.
Can I pause you there for just a moment? As I understand the appellant's brief, the appellant's arguing not just that he was not allowed to present evidence at the hearing, but was not allowed to present that on the merits of the OFP petition, but was not allowed to present evidence that would have responded to the allegations of a discovery rule violation. And do you understand his argument, as I do, to challenge both?
I believe so, Your Honor.
So how does a district court act within its discretion if it does not allow evidence, how does the district court act within its discretion to issue a sanction for a discovery rule violation if it doesn't allow a party to present evidence about the violation itself?
Well, Your Honor, the appellant never made any offers of proof. The appellant never tried to make a record of the evidence that was excluded. Additionally, the trial court warned the appellant that if he continued to refuse to engage in discovery, that he would face possible sanctions, including up to the exclusion of evidence. Your Honor, the appellant repeatedly refused to disclose a witness list, refused to share documents that he specifically stated he intended to introduce at trial. He ignored document requests and he ignored subpoenas. And then on the first day of trial, the appellant showed up with witnesses in tow and a stack of evidence that he intended to introduce. And so the trial court granted Ms. Diallo's motion to exclude, number one, any witness testimony from witnesses that were not previously disclosed, and number two, any evidence that was sought from appellant but that he had refused to provide. Importantly, Your Honors, the exclusion only applied to the appellant's case in chief, and the appellant was also permitted to testify, which he did testify. I'll also note that he had an opportunity to cross-examine Ms. Diallo, and he cross-examined her over 2 days of trial. The trial court's exclusion of evidence that appellant failed to disclose was not an abuse of discretion. The appellant also argues that the judge failed to consider certain testimony from the appellant, but the March 25th findings and order, Your Honor, make clear that the judge did consider the appellant's testimony, and as you've noted, the trial court has broad discretion in weighing witness credibility. The appellant next argues that he received ineffective assistance of counsel. In Minnesota, Your Honors, there is no civil right to counsel in an OFP proceeding. This court already considered this very issue as recently as 2017 in the case of Hicks v. Hicks.
If we were to change our mind on that in this case and say that there is a right to counsel in an OFP case, do you concede that his counsel was ineffective in failing to follow the discovery rules, leaving him prejudiced by the exclusion of evidence?
No, Your Honor. In Minnesota, where there are statutes in other instances that provide for a civil right to counsel, courts have applied Sixth Amendment case law to determine whether counsel was ineffective. And that means applying the Supreme Court decision of Strickland.
Right. And wouldn't this be a case under Strickland where, I mean, if a lawyer blows a deadline or refuses to respond to discovery and leaves his client unable to present evidence that bears upon the proceeding, isn't that ineffective assistance of counsel?
The appellant has not demonstrated prejudice, Your Honor. In this case, they made no record of the evidence that was excluded. And there's simply nothing in the record from which Your Honors can determine whether he was prejudiced. Even in their brief, the appellant does not make compelling arguments about how he was prejudiced, about what...
Could we infer the basis for prejudice when, on your argument that he showed up with a parade of witnesses and a stack of documents that were excluded?
Well, Your Honor, in another case that the appellant cited in Kimmelman v. Morris, the Supreme Court considered a similar issue where the trial counsel refused to engage in discovery and failed to conduct any discovery. And the Supreme Court in that case found that under the first Strickland factor, the counsel was ineffective, but that there was not enough of a record to satisfy prejudice and to satisfy the second factor. That's the case here, Your Honor. The appellant did not make any record of the evidence and further did not connect any specific errors in his brief that the trial counsel made to any prejudice against him.
Counsel for appellant brought up civil Gideon and recognized that theory has not been adopted in Minnesota, but as a matter of principle, why shouldn't we?
Well, Your Honor, in the past, this court has specifically stated that the task of extending existing law lies with the Supreme Court or the legislature. Respectfully, Your Honor, this court should not extend. The appellant asks this court to write new law, and that should be a matter left to the Supreme Court or the legislature, and it should not be something that this court undertakes in this case. But nonetheless, Your Honor, your honors do not need to determine whether appellant was entitled to a right to counsel at the OFP proceeding because he hasn't satisfied that second Strickland factor. Respectfully, Your Honors, we request that the order for protection be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. No, there is no rebuttal at this time.
Well, thank you. Thank you to both counsel for presenting your briefs in this case and for your oral arguments today. The matter is submitted at this time. We've taken it under advisement, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory period.